All right, everybody, welcome to Comedy on Vinyl. This week, remote, we have Rocky Mountain Mike with us. Your name's Mike Hardiman. You have been doing political satire for how long?
For about 7 years now, as far as like an ongoing thing.
And you wanted to specifically, I'm so glad somebody finally picked a Freeburg album. You wanted to do The United States of America, Volume 1, the early years.
Right.
Oh, it's so good.
It's amazing. I mean, all the people that are on it, you know, Paul Frees, June Foray, and Jesse White, and the whole, you know, cast of his stuff.
And you don't see that happen that much anymore, where you get, like, the great voice actors of the day all just compiled onto this one genius album. You know, they're all spread about on podcasts and stuff, but it is, like, it's a who's who of voice actors, if nothing else.
Yeah, and it's really funny to listen to it so many years later, because a lot of it is topical at the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of Kennedy references in there and stuff. It's really great.
Now, you just so everybody knows, the reason you picked this album, because you had obviously had a ton of influences, but your album, Politically Incoherent, is it out now or is it coming out? Because I know
there's been it's been out for a couple of months now.
Couple months, yeah. Okay. And it's you lampoon the hell out of a lot of people, and it's really funny stuff. It's sketch, it's music. Do you compose all the stuff yourself?
Well, you know, we used a couple of we did a couple of song parodies, so obviously I didn't compose those.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the performances of the music, a lot of it I did myself, like on It's My Party and I'll Lie If I Want To.
Mm-hmm.
I did all the tracks on that, played the saxophone and the piano
The
guitar and everything. So that was fun.
You know, I often wonder, thinking about this, because, I mean, I'm used to doing DIY comedy because it's just how I grew up, that you had to do it that way. But we're listening, and I'll put some clips into this, of The United States of America, Volume 1. It's just this beautifully produced thing that probably took just a ton of people to put together. But now it's just standard that, just accepted, it's that you would have to do all this stuff yourself in order to get it made. You know, I don't think anybody would put something like this together
anymore. The production values have to be there. And I just listened to the album again this afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And what struck me about it was, I don't remember the exact year, but this had to be like 1962, I think. And it had to be, the most they could have had to work with was four tracks.
Right.
Possibly two-track recording, but the production values are just amazing. You can tell that if they did have all those musicians playing at once, they did a really great job of just performing it live, in addition to all the voice track and the Foley and everything like that. It just is really a great technical achievement.
Yeah, I mean, it's strong in sketch, because I'm a big fan. If you're going to do audio sketch, you've got to have, like you said, great Foley. That's key to the atmosphere. Otherwise, it's just dead. It's just a bunch of words. You have to nail it with all that. And this is a pretty perfect album. You know, for as much as some of the things might be dated, I think for the most part, it still holds up.
Yeah, and I guess that a lot of that credit goes to all the years that Stan and the cast spent in radio.
Right.
So they were already like seasoned pros by the time they got to this album.
Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of people now, because radio is not, I mean, it's unfortunately dying as a medium, radio is just not a thing people are getting their feet wet in. They are having to, like me, just teach themselves, learn it for themselves. But I'm curious what your background is and what got you, how long you've been doing any kind of satire or in general. I know you've been writing for a long time, so what's your background?
Well, I grew up in near Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
But I grew up listening to all these albums. I remember distinctly when I first heard The First Family at my friend's house, and this friend of mine, he had a tape recorder, and we would, you know, make these little goofy comedy albums when we were just, you know, 10-year-old kids.
Awesome.
And so it was inevitable, I think, that I ended up in radio.
Mm-hmm.
I started my first radio job when I was 18. I was working weekends at a little daytime station in this little town in Oklahoma. And then immediately started at the college radio station. And that was the big time for me, because I got to play rock and roll for the first time. And I majored in broadcasting, And after a couple of years of that, I decided I was throwing my money away on the education part of it, and just decided to, just become a full-time radio personality. And so I did that for like the next 10 years, mostly in Tulsa. I did a stint in Little Rock for a while. When I was 29, I decided I really kind of needed to pay attention to my parents and go back to college. I always wanted to do that. Sure. I always wanted to do something a little more quote-unquote serious with my life. And I don't think it was until I got really out of radio that I really began to appreciate just how much I'd accomplished in radio.
Sure.
And just how creative the people were that were around me. But as far as doing the bits and that kind of stuff, I right when I was 18, 19 years old, we were doing these multi-voice bits for the radio for the college station. So I've kind of always done it.
Yeah, that's so much fun. I'm curious how you evolve, and again, obviously having not heard your early stuff, because I mean, I did live in Oklahoma briefly for about a year and a half when I was a baby, but so I'm not really familiar with your early stuff, of course. But I'm curious for you, and maybe it's not an easy thing to mark, but how you evolve from, and maybe it wasn't typical radio comedy, but how you evolve from radio comedy to doing something maybe a little more pointed, like, you know, really strong satire.
I think the elements are kind of there. I mean, I think it's all satire and parody. And the reason for that is, especially in radio, you don't have very much time to do a quote unquote setup.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't do a lot of like sketch kind of material. You have the listener has to get what you're doing within like the first 5 or 10 seconds.
Sure, sure.
They really have to understand what's going on. And so parody really lends itself to that. What you typically do as a radio personality is, you know, they would always say, the guys that I would run into that were more experienced, they would read three newspapers a day, and
mm-hmm.
and what really in those days helped to keep it more to the point was, especially if you weren't doing mornings, you had to do whatever humor you were going to do over the intro of a 12-second intro of a record.
Right,
And so whatever it was you were getting across, you had to, like, make it happen fast. But sometimes, once in a while, you would do, like, a pre-recorded bit that mm-hmm. maybe involved another person or something like that. Again, particularly if you were doing mornings.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of stuff really is – it's just – all you have to do is expand on that a little bit to kind of get into – what you might call a little meatier stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's the great thing about the CD format is the album format is that we could pursue a theme and kind of, you know, have several different tracks that kind of come back to the same theme.
Sure.
Over and over again.
And you know, there's a lot in the Freeberg album too of that, obviously, and thematically they get to play with music a lot more than a lot of people do. Like, you know, these beautiful orchestral bits, they get to call back and pull back and play with it and comment on it. The piece with the bit about the French horns where they keep
French horns. Yes, and they just kept coming back to that over and over again.
It's,
and it was so funny because I couldn't help listening to the album and going, oh my God, we stole that!
You know, right.
That I didn't even realize it. You know, we're doing this same thing in the bit that's called "The Bandits of Medicine Gulch." It's an old West bit,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the lead character guy, the hero guy, is introduced to his faithful Indian companion, Kondo, you know, and he said, you know, he just kind of goes, ugh. And, oh, that's how you say hello. And he says, no, you stand on Kondo's foot. Same thing. You know, same.
Right.
It's the same sort of cheesy Stan Freeberg kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even, it's funny because one of the guys on the album, Jeff Hoyt, who played that, you know, that cowboy character,
mm-hmm.
Actually has spent a little time with Stan Freeberg. And we're both big admirers of his. And it wasn't until we were done with the album that we really realized, oh, my God, we did a lot of Stan Freeberg in there.
Yeah.
You know?
At least you're pulling from the best possible stuff, and to recognize it in your own work has got to be at least somewhat satisfying, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, and it really says a lot about him because he and a lot of other, you know, Spike Jones, people like that, mm-hmm. they got down the gist of what this was going to be really early on
mm-hmm.
in the whole process, and we're all just sort of paying homage to that.
Hello there. We white men, other side of ocean, my name Christopher Columbus.
Oh, you over here on a Fulbright?
Huh? No, I'm over here on an Isabella, as a matter of fact. Which reminds me, I want to take a few of you guys back with me in the boat to prove I discovered you.
What do you mean, discover us? We discover you.
You discovered us?
Certainly. We discover you on beach here, is all how you look at it.
Yeah, I never thought of that. Well, at any rate, my men and I were wondering if you could spare a little food.
What kind num-nums you want?
Well, what is that strange-looking plant you're holding there, with little yellow kernels?
You mean this?
Yes. What is that?
French horns.
No. What you're holding in your hand?
Oh, corn.
That's what I thought it was. What else you got to eat around here?
Oh, berries, herbs, natural fruits, and organically grown vegetables.
You know, you were talking earlier about doing radio, and obviously you have to deal with an attention span or you have to deal with a time limitation simply because of the intro of a song. You know, a lot of people talk about, they say that the more recent generations, like the millennials, have almost no attention span thanks to MTV, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, if you listen to this album, I mean, sure, there can be a couple bits that maybe don't hit immediately, but it's still fairly fast-paced, and the idea that, you have to get the gist immediately, especially with a parody. You have to, I know that song within the first two bars. You know, it speaks to just, I don't know, maybe it's just a general American sense, not necessarily, a generational thing. What do you think?
I think it really, if you listen, like the longest track on there is like 10 minutes long, and it's mm-hmm. the whole thing about Columbus going in. And it does kind of, by today's standards, it does kind of go on a little long, mm-hmm. but it covers two or three different scenes, really. And when you're listening to it, you just really, and most of Stan Freberg's stuff, you just feel like you're listening to a radio show.
Right, right.
And I think one of the reasons that his stuff was really, you know, peaking in the early 60s was, that was the time when everybody was getting their first Magnavox.
Sure.
And stereo was really coming along, and hi-fi was really starting to move in.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how people, they really made full use of that. You can hear a lot of the separation and everything in the bits. And I really think a lot of the technology at the time had a lot to do with that, sort of keeping people's attention span. Plus, people still were not averse to sitting around a family and
sure.
listening to a whole album together.
Yeah. You know, that is something that I think I neglect a little too often on here, is the fact that whenever there's a new technology, people play with it, and it tends to be at least fascinating enough to allow a few albums to sort of play out in that genre. I mean, there's so, you know, once the wall of sound was invented, how many albums used that? Eventually, sure, maybe we got sick of it, but, you know, it was this brand new, beautiful thing to us. People don't think about that in terms of comedy that often.
Yeah, plus there was no competition really to speak of on television. First Family album sold 7 million copies, and a big reason for that was there was no Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
There was no Daily Show. There was nothing like that around,
mm-hmm.
and the comedy album really kind of ruled that whole genre.
Yeah. Yeah, and something so precious, too. I mean, I feel like this is... I mean, Freberg's known for being incredibly irreverent, but it's one of those things where I do wish I could have been a fly on the wall to listen to people first hearing these things when, again, the unfortunate thing is that American history, even only a few decades ago, is always painted as this beautiful pastoral Leave It to Beaver thing. We're just post Leave It to Beaver with this, and, you know, the idea that people couldn't be irreverent is this weird falsehood that people live under, and it's very funny to me to listen to something, and the fact that I get shocked by it is very odd to me. I shouldn't be shocked, you know. I
laughed out loud when I heard the idea that you get an Indian, you know, Native American running mate. Well, what happens if you die? He'll be taking his orders from Chief So-and-so. That's a direct reference to Kennedy and the Pope.
Right.
And that's certainly irreverent. That's very, and Stan Freberg has mentioned on a few interviews I've seen him with, of where he's, you know, he's run into people that come and say, I'm sorry, you can't say this or that. He's been a little too cutting edge for his time.
Yeah.
Here and there.
Yeah. Did you own this album, or did you just listen to it over at a friend's house?
Oh, I have a copy of it, yeah.
Did you first...
Oh, at the time.
Yeah, at the time, yeah, right.
No. You know, my first comedy albums were Bill Cosby.
Okay.
If you don't count the Chipmunks, I think the very first album I ever bought was a Chipmunks record. I bought it the same day my sister bought Meet the Beatles.
Oh, my God.
Which would have been 50 years ago this week.
Yeah.
She got Meet the Beatles, and I got Let's All Sing with the Chipmunks.
That's
because
amazing.
I was nine, and, you know, so...
They are the only vermin to ever chart, so, you know, you didn't have too bad taste. It's some of the first early comedy to chart, I think.
Yeah, and so, but, you know, later, when I consciously bought a comedy album, it was... Say, Why Is There Air? And
sure.
Wonderfulness. And I started out as a child and 200 miles per hour. And I reveled in all that stand up. And, but you know, I mean, there was television too. And,
sure.
You know, I was a huge fan of the Dick Van Dyke Show when I was 7 years old. I was screaming my head off at that. I remember that was the week that was. So that was like the original Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, there was quite a bit of that kind of stuff on television and Stan Freberg as well.
Yeah.
But it was actually my friends who I think had hip enough parents to buy the the Freeberg stuff, you know.
So was it a matter of going over to their houses and all just doing the same thing you might do with a family, but just with your buddies?
Oh yeah, yeah. My friend Barbie Wall, her dad was the only person I knew that had an actual bona fide hi-fi, with a Macintosh amp and the big speakers everything. And I'm like, oh my God! And she put on St. George and the Dragonette. You know, and of course, as many people did with those comedy albums, they had like memorized, you know.
Sure.
And so you spend your time on the playground, shouting the lines back. What's a 412? And then later on in high school, it was George Carlin and stuff.
Sure. Is it easy to track the kind of comedy that you were attracted to more at the beginning? I mean, were you listening to irreverent stuff and not getting it? Or I'm just curious, like, that early stuff, was it hitting you on this gut level as a kid, and then eventually you sort of gravitated towards more stuff that was a little more, under the radar for other people?
I think you joke about the Chipmunks, but I mean, the Chipmunks is that kind of... the reason, you know, the Alvin character is always flying in the face of authority of David Seville. And so that's kind of a theme. I don't remember really appreciating satire until I was probably, 10 or 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I heard The First Family, it was several years after the Kennedy assassination. But it was still funny, you know.
Yeah.
And I think I got that. And by then, David Fry and guys like that were on Ed Sullivan and stuff. So,
sure.
Ed Sullivan was a great source of comedy.
Yeah.
Because he would always have a comic on every year, every week.
Right. Did your, and I apologize if you already mentioned this, but did your parents collect much or buy much in terms of comedy? Or were they other types of music people? Or
There was, I think it was buying the Magnavox. They felt like they had to buy every Broadway musical score in the world. So, and my older sister was really into that. So they had, Camelot and Oklahoma and My Fair Lady and all that. And my dad and mom were both huge country and Western people, Hank Williams and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't really, they didn't identify with pop at all. And they didn't even really like Sinatra or anything all that much.
Yeah. So you did kind of just have to go completely out of your comfort zone originally. Is that right?
Yeah, but I was really lucky. My closest friends growing up were very, very funny people.
Mm-hmm.
On par with really anybody in terms of talent. I was very fortunate as far as that goes.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, just pulling the album up here, do you have a favorite track off of this record?
Off of the Freebird?
Yes, right.
I don't know. They're all kind of pretty much the same as far as the level of talent and mm-hmm. laughs, I guess. I guess I like the scene. I like the scene where Columbus is trying to talk the Queen Isabella into going to America.
Right.
You know, I like that. She's like, I'll send for you. No, you won't. You know, and it's just. There's a lot of that, and how the Jesse White character, I guess he was the king, he's going to America because his doctor says he needs to summer in Florida.
Right. I mean, some of my favorite satire ever is, and I mean, a lot of this is, the real edge of the satire comes from dulling the edge of the importance of the subject. You know, that irreverence just kind of, I mean, just taking history and taking the piss out of it. See, it seems simple, but it feels incredibly important to me, you know. Do you find having to do that in your own work at any point? Because, I mean, obviously you get the opportunity to sort of comment on more recent stuff. But
yeah, and that's what that's why I intentionally put an Old West bit in there. Mm-hmm. I wanted to specifically handle healthcare with an Old West bit, but you know, it was fun to throw in the reference there to you know, General Custer's noticed an increase in Indian smoke signal chatter.
Right.
You can just and you had Aloysius Wiener on the Telegraph, you know, describing his penis on the Telegraph. All you have to do is take something that's iconic, like the Old West Telegraph, and merge it with, you know, something modern, and mm-hmm. it gets a laugh. And that's exactly what Freeburg does in a lot of the, you know, the Purchase of Manhattan and you know, the pulling up all the trees. And what, did you think you were getting a furnished island?
150 eventful years have passed. A new spirit of restlessness grips the 13 English colonies, smarting from what seems to them injustice at the hands of King George III, the American colonists yearn for liberty. Boston Harbor, 1774. Two figures huddle on the deck of a cargo ship, there in the darkness.
Whoops.
Jeez, Charlie, you knocked that whole load of tea in the water there.
Well, I miscalculated with the block and tackle, that's
yeah,
all.
Yeah, well, I mean, you blew it. You missed the whole deck there.
Yeah, well, maybe nobody will notice.
Well, what do you mean? There's tea floating all over the place. I mean, how can I go and demand an hourly increase for you guys?
Yeah,
with
yeah, well,
fringe?
I,
no, with fringe benefits and all that. If my men keep knocking stuff overboard.
Well, I'm sorry.
Sorry doesn't do any good, Charlie. Now, I'll cover for you this time, but let's get our story straight.
Good,
okay?
good.
Now, a bunch of those Patriot guys came sneaking around dressed up in...
How about in Indian suits?
That's good, in Indian suits.
Good.
They were a little loaded, and they shoved the tea over because they were sore about the tea tax, okay?
Okay. You think anybody will swallow that?
How many albums in is this for you, Politically Incoherent? How many albums have you done?
This is the first.
This is the first.
Yeah.
After all,
yeah.
After working on this stuff for that long. So is it, did you find yourself having to sort of say, oh, this is too old, I can't use it, I can't bring it back?
Well, I had a lot of stuff it really started in my mind when I was first approached by the record company to do it. I just had in my mind, well, we're just going to throw... At that time, I had a lot of song parodies. We'll throw a lot of song parodies on an album because those were really popular. And then we ran into a brick wall, discovering that, particularly with political themes, you can't get rights to use a lot of material, a lot of music. That really kind of threw me off. So I began digging through a lot of the pre-produced bits we'd already done for the Stephanie Miller Show, which is a comedy political talk show nationwide. And tried to find those bits that still had shelf life.
Yeah.
Anything that had to do with Romney or the election of 2012, we had to throw away, which was a real heartbreaker.
I bet.
We had a lot of funny stuff. You know, I mean, Mitt was just, I mean, he was comedy gold. and you know, Bachman. And we managed to, I really have blown off Sarah Palin as well, but she kept coming back. You know,
right.
Bless her heart. She just, every time you thought she was gone, she was, oh, no, I'm still here.
She's tenacious.
And, yeah, so that was a godsend. Oh, you can still use her. Great.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took a lot of the stuff, a lot of the shorter bits that we'd done for the radio, and then thought, okay, we need to come up with some more sketch-type bits. So the Gay Agenda was one of those,
mm-hmm.
and Sarah Palin's Story of America, which, if you listen to that, that's like the entire Freeburg album in two and a half minutes.
Right, yeah.
And again, I didn't think about that album at all. I mean, it wasn't really an album that I'd spent a lot of time thinking about. It just kind of had gone away for 40 years.
Sure. So. Do you think the great music and the wonderful production values is something that might stick in your brain a little more because it's musical? I mean, I for me, I noticed that musical comedy tends to, whether I like it or not even, tends to stick with me more than spoken word, than stand-up. Do you ever notice anything like that?
Well, music has a tendency to do that because it imprints more of your brain. There's so much more information going on there. Mm-hmm. And Stan Freberg's stuff, you know, if you listen to Green Christmas, there's like a 6-minute cut, but it's got all these musical numbers in it, and it's clearly to help it move along and make it entertaining. I don't think that, and actually Freberg has an album that came out not too long ago, like a year ago. And there's quite a bit of music in there, but it's not sort of a musical kind of approach where the music goes in and out of all this dialogue. But that was clearly his, I think, his signature. And I think the reason is it just makes it more digestible, makes it easier to move through from scene to scene and set up different scenes.
Sure.
And all those scenes are only a couple of minutes long each.
Right. I feel like it's a little more forgiving that way. Maybe. Yeah. You maybe can get away with a little more than you might be able to.
You know, we're working on a second album now. It's starting to put a little bug in my ear that maybe we ought to do something similar. I don't want to directly rip off anybody.
Of course.
But I've already discussed with the record company what we might do on the second album, and it will be more sketch oriented. It'll be more situational oriented, and not so much sort of these commercials and not necessarily song parodies. We still want to do a lot of song parodies, but you have no idea how much work it is to go and find people to do them. Because if you go and you say, "Look, we want to do a song parody to a publishing company," what songs could we parody? They're not going to do it that way.
They're not going to volunteer it, right?
Give us what you're going to do, and we'll say yes or no. So that means you have to actually go out and produce all of these things just so they can turn around and say no. So it's a lot of work.
That's
it really
insane.
Is.
I wouldn't have thought of it that way. That kind of...
And again and again, people have equated my sort of brand with song parody because there's so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason there's so many of them is because they're easier to do minute for minute than doing the sketches.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a lot of fun. But I think my personal feeling is that bits, comedy routines are actually funnier because you're bringing a new concept in every few seconds.
Sure.
And you're getting a laugh every few seconds. Whereas a song, people know what's coming up on the song.
Right.
And so the only question is, well, what did they do with that lyric?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it really holds up as well.
You know? I can see that, yeah. Songs, obviously, the theme has to be overt, literally and figuratively. You know, the musical theme and the theme of the piece, where I guess you can be a little more subversive with sketch.
Yeah, and people don't know, you can do theater of the mind, you know. You can do so many things where people's imaginations come into play. And also, like you say, it's easier to surprise them. That's what humor is. It's just a funny surprise.
I'm curious, the part of Oklahoma you're in, are you a bit of an outcast for being as liberal as your comedy is?
Yeah, it's a liberal album, and it's the thing is, I'm not really known here for comedy that much.
Okay.
Only a few of my friends here really know that I do this, and it's not because I'm keeping it a secret or anything. It's just I don't want to even bother trying with people, because regardless of how red a state it is, it has a lot to do with just how well informed you are, because a lot of the humor, if you don't know what the memes are, if you don't really pay that much attention to popular culture, you're not necessarily going to get it. Now, that's not to say I have plenty of liberal friends here, and they, of course, get it. But it is, it is very different. Oklahoma Magazine just did an interview with me that just came out last week. And it'll be interesting to see how many people that are in Oklahoma will reach out to me or slash my tires or whatever.
Oh,
but it's, I always tell people who aren't really from here, it's Oklahoma. It's not Mississippi.
You mm-hmm. know, it's
not,
sure.
It's not as bad as it might sound.
Sure. No. And it's easy to generalize, and that becomes. Do you?
One of my closest friends here is from L.A. and he grew up in L.A. and he moved here like 15 years ago, and he loves it.
Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised. Well, again, like I said, I lived in Oklahoma very briefly, but you know, the last time I drove through, I was shocked to just, you know, to like it so much, because I was a much younger man and I was afraid of everybody hating me, and you know, I would say
it's certainly not a paradise, but right. You know, having been here and spent some, and I photographed it. I'm a landscape photographer. Oh. I was sort of the Oklahoma guy. I've got a book on Oklahoma, and so I actually have been to more places in this state than most of the people I know who live here.
Wow.
So I've been able to appreciate for its natural beauty,
mm-hmm.
But don't get me wrong, there are some really stupid people.
And now we get to the meat of it. Oh, my God. Do you remember the first comedy, anything you ever wrote? Was it, I know you said you did a lot of sketch stuff as a kid. Do you have any, do you remember any of that stuff?
You know, we had to write our own sketches in Boy Scouts.
Mm-hmm.
We actually, when we get to Boy Scout camp, we would do these, we did a pantomime bit where you run up a sheet and you do shadows behind the sheet of, you know, bonking someone over the head with a frying pan and stuff like that, with the Foley that goes with that and everything.
That's awesome.
So, I remember that. I don't remember specifically writing any lines for that or mm-hmm. anything, but I do remember in college radio doing a couple of I did a commercial for a place that sold beer, and it was like a convenience store. And mm-hmm. I remember doing it sort of a Italian guy sitting out in the middle of the water, drinking a beer and doing the copy for this place. And meanwhile, there's a shark. It was when Jaws was out.
Uh-huh,
so the
okay.
Jaws music is coming. People are at the shore, you know, yelling at him to get out of the water. And he's not heeding the warning. And then, you know, then it ends with him doing literally the Daffy Duck, you know, kind of thing. He's running away from the shark. I was probably 19 when I wrote that.
Yeah. It's awesome to be able to experiment and then get the results that young. I feel like, my first album that I ever made, I was 19, but I mean, it was self-distributed, self-produced, not great, but to have yourself tested in a place where you could be fired has got to be interesting at 19. You know?
Yeah, well, it was college radio, and, you know, it's funny, I spent 6 hours working on that 30-second commercial,
mm-hmm.
and this is with very rudimentary, you know, well, we had two-track recorders,
mm-hmm.
but you had, like, if you wanted to do Foley or something like that, you had to bring in several different tape recorders, and we did this, and the client rejected it. He just said, oh, there's too much Jaws stuff, and they went with this really awful production that was just some guy in a voiceover. It sounded like he was on drugs, and which was very popular at the time.
Sure.
Come on and put your name on the dotted line.
I got to be particular what I sign.
It's just a piece of paper.
Just a piece of paper, that's what you say.
Come on and put your signature on the list.
It looks to have a very subversive twist.
How silly to assume it. Won't you nom de plume it today? You're so skittish. Who possibly could care if you do?
The Un-British Activities Committee, that's who.
Let's have a little drinko and fill the quill.
It sounds a little pinko to me, but still.
Knock off the timid manner if you want a banner to ray.
Banner to ray.
You must take,
I must take,
a stand,
for this brave
new land,
for who wants,
to live,
so conservative,
but if,
he don't disagree,
but a man can't be too careful what he signs these days.
Yeah, but we used to do, when I did mornings, I used to work for Roy Clark, actually. Roy Clark owned this country station that I worked at in Tulsa, and that was a really fun job. And I had a friend who did imitations, who was a news guy, and I remember him coming, it was when Carter was president. So I had him come over and do his Jimmy Carter. And
awesome.
You know, so we did stuff like that.
Do you remember your first comedy song?
Oh. you know, this is so weird. this is the week of the 50th anniversary of the Beatles on Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
And I don't know why this popped into my head, but suddenly I remembered going around the playground and doing a riff on I Want to Hold Your Hand. And I was 9 years old, and I was doing my Frankenstein, and I was singing I want to grab your neck, you know. And so that was like, you know, parody song zero.
That's amazing. What draws people to do that? I mean, I've done it too, not well, but I mean, I don't know, because, you know, it's not something everybody does. I mean, you know, I don't. Do you have any sense?
And once you start, you never stop.
Oh, no. Of course, yeah. I mean, obviously you have to be musically inclined, I guess, but I just wonder at 9, what about you just made you think it was okay to sing out loud? And I don't know, did it seem natural that you remember, or was it just like, oh, crap, I had this great idea?
I think just little plays on songs were just popular then. And
sure.
A lot of people did that. You mm-hmm. know, Over Hill, Over Dale, We Have Just Escaped from Jail, and the coppers are hot on our trail.
Of course.
I remember that from the Boy Scouts.
That's so funny.
And I was already playing keyboards when I was 6.
Mm-hmm.
So I was already doing some kind of music, you know. So it is weird, though. It is kind of hard to pinpoint. Where did that come from?
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Were your parents musical at all, or...?
Not really, especially my mom's side of the family. Nothing there. My dad's side of the family had the music. My dad loved music, and he loved all kinds of music. He loved symphonic music.
Mm-hmm.
He liked to, you know, we would put on the record player, and he would sing along to Camelot. You know, he loved to sing all the time. He passed away about a year ago, and he had Alzheimer's, and he was the last 6 months of his life. He was in a home. And he, you know, he was pretty good about, though he had Alzheimer's, he was pretty good about recognizing people and stuff
mm-hmm.
right up until the very, very end. But right, I mean, literally up till the end, he was singing like every day. And
wow.
The nurses really liked to hear him sing. And he would sing Johnny Cash records and stuff.
Wow. That's a hell of a memory to leave with people. That's amazing.
I mean, it's, you know, as you know, he couldn't tell you what had transpired 5 minutes earlier,
sure.
But he could, if I put on Pandora and put on the Bob Wills channel,
mm-hmm.
whatever the obscure song was from the 50s, he would just be right there with the lyrics.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing about old memories and music.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I wish I knew more about brain architecture to know why that is. I'm sure there are studies out there, and now I could read a whole book on it, because that's not uncommon. Again, that stuff sticks with you for so long. It seems to be the stuff that's the strongest emotional, you know, people can get, my own grandmother has, you know, she's got dementia. I'm not sure what form of it, but, you know, the stuff that seems to stick with her is stuff like either a favorite movie or a favorite song or... something that seemed incredibly traumatic to her when she was a kid, even if it's something she never brought up in her life, as far as anybody knew. There are these weird little pockets that your brain picks, but music always sort of seems to be there. It's interesting.
And I think, again, for me, this friend of mine, Will Dees, who I grew up with, Chris Dees was his name. He later liked to be called Will.
Mm-hmm.
He was possibly the most talented person I ever knew, and he was a really funny actor and really great guitarist and musician. And we would do these little bits where we would get on the tape recorder. And for some reason, we did some sort of like cheesy science fiction thing where we landed on another planet.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, you know, just going back and forth. And I think we were like, you know, 9 or 10 years old then.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, your friends will, I think, influence you greatly in terms of doing things like that where other people just don't get it. And,
yes.
You know, they don't think it's funny or whatever. But
do you have any of those tapes still around? I'm just curious.
No, I would kill to have them. But, you know, when he passed away 7 or 8 years ago, and I'm still in touch with his parents to get a lot of the cassettes that he made, like in our early 20s, I think I'm on a couple of those, so those are definitely priceless for sure.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I only ask because I do this podcast and I do another one. It's with my best friend of 20 years where we have been starting from the beginning of us thinking we're doing comedy at about 13, 14. And luckily we have almost all that stuff on tape, so we just get to sit back and listen to ourselves be idiots at 13 and kind of watch ourselves evolve, you know? And
yeah, I think archiving things I've never been good at. And I made a small film when I was in high school that was kind of a comedy. And my dad, you know, bless his heart, was cleaning out the attic one day, 30 years ago, and just tossed out this movie.
No.
And, I never forgave him for that. That's the only thing I had that was really like that, that was, you know, already in some kind of medium that you would expect to save.
Right, right. You know what I think would be good? This is a good time for if people haven't heard, and again, if people are listening to my podcast, this is the first time we've talked about Stan Freberg, so you're going to be the guy to tell them why listen to Stan Freberg, and particularly why listen to this album. What's special about it if you don't know anything about him?
Well, if you are interested in what this kind of comedy was and how Freberg was a master of it, or just interested in early audio comedy, that I guess radio comedy, it's good because it takes all those elements together, and also political comedy because it has a couple of little jabs in there. He does a little left versus right kind of stuff, and it's just interesting to hear something that's 50 years old and the take that they had on it, and also keep in mind that there was no political comedy really ongoing on television or anything. This is, again, before Saturday Night Live. And sure. I think people have always enjoyed sort of sitting around the campfire and swapping these kinds of stories about current events.
Sure.
And this was the medium to do that in those days.
That's perfect. Mike, thank you so much for picking this and for coming on. What do you want to plug? Twitter, Facebook, more about the album, where can we find it all?
The album is called Politically Incoherent, and you can get it on Amazon or iTunes. You can also go to politicallyincoherent.us to order a copy. It's also available at Best Buy and Barnes & Noble, and would really appreciate you picking up a copy and letting us know what you think about it. And hopefully by the late summer we'll have a second album out, and we'll be addressing a lot of what's going to happen this year with the midterms and all
awesome.
The current craziness. Yeah.
That's so good. Are you on Twitter? Is the album on Twitter?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. It's at Rocky MNTN Mike at Rocky Mountain Mike, and you can also follow me on Facebook, Rocky Mountain Mike.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Mike. This has been a lot of fun. I put clips of Stan Freberg throughout it. Is there a song you would like of yours that you'd like me to put in here, or a track of yours that you'd like at the end or something?
I think the star bit, as far as I think the star bit on the album is Constar.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes,
right. The first track.
Mm-hmm.
And that one's, you know, it's reasonably short, and it's I think it's possibly the funniest thing on there.
It's pretty great. It's a fun album, and it was fun to listen to, and it was great to listen to Stan Freberg too. So thanks for giving me an excuse to do that. again, thank you so much for being here, and everybody, thank you for listening, and have a good
thanks,
thing.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you. Have a good thing, everybody.
I tell you, the world is flat, and that's that.
It's round as your hat.
It's flat as your head.
It's round.
It's flat.
It's a round, round world. It's a round, round world. I contend it's round, and it's going to be found when all the results are in. It's a round world now, and it's always been.
Flat, flat world. It's a flat, flat world. I insist it's flat as a welcoming mat, and he's sailing off the end. How about our crazy Australian
friend? Get hip, would I climb aboard this ship? If I didn't have odds, the earth was highly spherical.
It's a miracle if it's
square, is. Square king. You're a square, square king. If you don't believe, you're gonna receive the shock of your royal life. When the ship
poles in at Miami.
Yo ho ho, and a Dramamine. We are loyal subjects of the king and queen. But what kind of nut would you have to be to borrow a ship and put out to sea when you don't know what's on the other side?
Oh, wait, got a heart attack, fun. Brother, who said getting there was half the fun? Give up my throne for one Navy bean. No wonder I'm turning 3 shades of green. How could I,
girl,
on such a lonely
crazy kind of scheme? It's a cockamamie dream.
What's the diamond or the ship?
We're going to scream.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit StolenDress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on Facebook.com/ComedyOnVinyl, Twitter @ComedyOnVinyl, and find everything else at ComedyOnVinyl.com.
The following is a recording of an actual ConStar call.
ConStar, please state the nature of your emergency.
Hey, my brother-in-law is in the car, and he is going on and on about Obamacare.
You know, every small business in America will have to fire everyone.
I cannot seem to control him.
I'm serious. Death panels, biggest tax increase in history.
So we were just going to this grocery store, you know, and I mentioned that my back was hurting. And he just started in.
You know who else had socialized medicine?
Okay, stay calm, sir.
Okay.
May I ask where your brother-in-law gets his news and information?
Well, I don't know. It's either Fox News or where he hangs out at the body shop.
No, I don't care. They have to wait 7 hours to see a doctor in Canada.
All right, sir. I'm sending you instructions on how to get to the nearest bookstore.
Okay. You know, I'm not even sure he can read.
That's okay, sir. They have picture books, graphic novels, and videos, too.
Doctors won't take Medicare no more.
Shut up!
With ConStar, if you're faced with neocon logic, you're never more than the touch of a button away from actual thinking people.